The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am excited to introduce our guests. Tonight, we're joined by Kristen Henning, the Bloom Professor of Law and Director of Juvenile Justice Clinic and Initiative at the Georgetown University Law Center. Professor Henning represents young people in Washington, D.C.'s Superior Court and conducts nationwide training of criminal justice institutions on the intersection of race, adolescence, and policing. She is the former lead attorney of the Juvenile Unit at the Public Defender Service for the District of Columbia and serves on the board of directors for the Center for Children's Law and Policy. In her historically sweeping, deeply researched, and essential new book, The Rage of Innocence, Henning exposes the day-to-day but widely obscured ways in which discriminatory and aggressive policing traumatizes Black children and adolescents and leads them to fear, resist, and resent the police. Tonight, she'll be in conversation with Marsha Levick, the co-founder, deputy director, and chief counsel of the Juvenile Law Center, the oldest public interest law firm for children in the United States. For more than 35 years, Ms. Levick has been an advocate for children's and women's rights. She has authored or co-authored numerous briefs before many federal and state courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court. Kristen Henning, Marsha Levick, thanks for being with us tonight. The screen is yours.
Thank you, Andy.
Thank you, Andy. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Marsha. Wonderful to be here with you.
Welcome to Philadelphia virtually. Yes. It's great to have you in our city. Let me first of all congratulate you on your fabulous book. I feel like I have been aware of your labor of love, and I suspect also perhaps a labor of duty and obligation to write this book. And it is great to see it in print. And I am really honored, so honored to be in conversation with you tonight to talk about this. So let me start at the very beginning. Why this book and why now?
Yeah, Marsha, as you know, I've been representing kids for 26 years in the nation's capital. And in that entire 26 years, I have only represented four white children. What am I saying? Only represented four white children in 26 years, which is just absolutely absurd, statistically impossible, because every other client that I've had has been African American. And so it's really hard to do this work for a very long time and first not want to blow up the system, but at a bare minimum, want to really just ask the questions like, is this happening everywhere else in the world, or everywhere else in the country at least? And what are the impacts on Black children as a result of this, you know, overrepresentation in the juvenile legal system? And so part of why now is that, but part of it is also just this deep desire to tell the stories of the children that I have been representing, the pain, the trauma that they've suffered as a result of this criminalization and this unique targeting. And so this book, you know, as Andy, you know, began to tell us, is yes, it has research and it has data, but more importantly, it is the stories, it's the narratives of Black children, not only from Washington, D.C., but really from all across the country, high profile stories that we've heard about kids coming in contact with the police, but told with a little bit more nuance than I think we have seen those stories told. And I think that, you know, the final thing I'll say about why now, it's really, I don't even know what the word is, but we've seen policing in the news quite a bit lately, obviously. And I have long believed that we needed a unique focus on the police youth relationship. And so I really wanted to zero in on that to elevate that in the conversation. So The timing will never go away. I was going to say the timing, you know, sort of the book got released right in the heart of some really high profile, you know, use of force cases involving Black children. But honestly, Marsha, anytime I wrote it, it would have been appropriate.
Well, I think that's the sad part of the story. Yes. It probably would have been appropriate. And I hope that our audience listened carefully to your comment about only representing four white children over the course of your 26 years. I am not surprised because of my own experience, but it is a stunning number. It is definitely not unique to the District of Columbia. And I also really want to acknowledge that at the end of the day, this is a book about the stories of children, the stories of Black children who have really suffered, not just at the hands of police. And again, I think that's an important part of the way you tell your story, which is to acknowledge that there are a lot of hands in this system, and there are a lot of players who have created the system that we are all kind of staring down right now. Yeah. So when I thought about our conversation tonight, because I know you and I know your work, I know how much we can fall back onto this is a story about policing and the over-policing of communities of color and especially Black children. And so I wanted to move us a little bit away from that top line idea and to allow you to walk us through the many ways, as you do in your book, of how it happens. How is it that Black youth end up being over-policed? It's not just because they're sitting on a stoop in their neighborhood. And I actually wanted to start with something that may seem odd. I was incredibly interested in your chapter about clothing and fashion and gender differences. Could you talk about that?
Absolutely. I mean, look, you know, the top line is absolutely, this is a book about the many ways in which Black children are criminalized for just being children. So all the things that we did and that we care about in we cared about in our teenage years, which includes, of course, the clothes that we wear, right? The friends that we have, the music that we listen to, all of that. And so just to take a tiny little peek into, you know, this conversation about children and clothing. So think about, I'm going to just start with sagging pants. There are laws on the books in cities across the country that make it illegal to wear your pants sagging. Now, I'll say from the outset, I don't want to see, you know, any child's underwear either. But the question is, why do we criminalize that, right? Why do we criminalize that? And particularly when you look at all of the other fashion statements or fashion, contemporary moments of fashion that we've never criminalized, right? So think about the all Black attire worn by teenagers in the goth, you know, era of the 1980s, all right? And those children, that style, you know, was associated with some mass shootings and some very serious violence. We never criminalized the clothing, right? Think about the tie-dye era of the hippies, right? You know, and again, that clothing, kids, you know, wearing that clothing were tended to be associated with, you know, drugs, hallucinogens, things of that nature. And then even today, Marsha, think about like the Doc Martens, steel-toed Doc Martens with, you know, red and blue, shoestrings, right? We don't criminalize that. There is something unique about the ways in which we criminalize Black fashion. We target Black children. And so that's just one of the many examples in the book. And you talk about gender. I mean, gender, like girls in particular, this is one of the particular ways in which Black girls are criminalized, particularly in the school context. So many of the dress code violations, contemporary dress code violations, are targeted at, consciously or subconsciously, at Black girls, right? Black girls are painted as if they are promiscuous, if they wear clothing that, you know, other girls wear. So wearing a short, you know, what, you know, the girls just call booty shorts, right? Well, maybe an African-American girl is a little, you know, more bodacious, right? Or, you know, more buxom, and her clothes look more, are portrayed as, you know, more sexualized. than, you know, another girl of another race who doesn't fill them out in quite the same way. So those are just some examples, but it's you know, it's traumatic and you know, physically, you know, I think about, like, for example, just one thing on the sagging pants, you know, so not only is the sagging pants might lead you to an arrest, even if it doesn't lead to an arrest, it leads to police contact, right? That then escalates into something else, right? Violence or aggression towards that child. So.
Well, and I think what's so interesting about how you talk about it is that so much of the ruling it out, the thing that says it's not okay to do this, comes out of the school environment.
Right.
And the school environment has been a feeder to the juvenile legal system for a couple of decades at least. And so we are confronted not only with really historical over-policing of communities of color, but we end up having a similar situation where Black youth in schools are effectively over-policed, over-supervised, overreacted to, all of which has the potential to, again, both bring them into contact with police, with school resource officers, and the greater likelihood that they penetrate the juvenile legal system.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what, Marsha, I'm going to push it back to beyond, you know, a couple of decades ago. And you touched on it, this historical, right, base. And I will say that in writing this book, I learned a lot about the evolution of police in schools. And so I will say, until I wrote this book, I bought into the often repeated narrative that police evolved or appeared in schools after Columbine, right? And because parents and teachers were afraid to send their kids to school after the mass shooting in 1999 in Colorado. But when you dig deeper and you really put the data with the dates, if you will, you see that, you know, and we sort of know this intuitively, but that the first police in schools appeared in Indianapolis in 1939 with the first hint of integration, the first conversations about integrating schools. And then school resource officers increased significantly in the civil rights era in response to the very clear and explicit attempt to integrate schools. And we've all seen those iconic photographs where, you know, police are standing out front with the purported goal of facilitating integration, but we know very well that they were very often there to impede those integration efforts. And here's the date that's really significant. The National Association of School Resource Officers formed in 1991, 8 years before Columbine. That means there were so many school resource officers by then that you've got national curricula, a national model, national association, 8 years before Columbine. All of that tied to that very racialized history. So when we talk about the, you know, the disproportionate referral of Black children to the school to prison pipeline, we also, we got to look back, you know, historically. And then once you get, and then, okay, so Columbine happens, 1999, and then federal funding does indeed increase for school resource officers. But where do those school resource officers get sent? They get sent to schools that have a disproportionately high presence of Black and brown children, right? Not to the white suburban areas where most of the mass school shootings took place. So once you get kids, police in schools, you've got more arrest of kids in schools and more arrest of Black children in particular. So the school to prison pipeline is definitely historically rooted.
And I do think that you're giving us that history in the book. Yeah, I think I'm one of many people who just tends to assume that all of this happened as a consequence of Columbine. And it's not just that it was formed, that the association was formed in 91, that it goes back to Indiana and Indianapolis, which is so much about, once again, the illusion of utilizing police or law enforcement to create safety,
right,
except for Black children and except for communities of color. One of the other things that struck me in thinking about this idea of clothing really as being an entryway, unfortunately, to this over-policing of kids, is just sort of the ways in which Black children do all of the things that white children do, except somehow they can't get away with it. Right. And one of the other parts of your book that I thought was really interesting, you refer to it as contempt of police.
Yes.
I made a note to myself, which was cursing while Black.
Yes.
Because that's, as I was reading the chapter, I thought that's what this is. It's, again, we have walking while Black, we have driving while Black, now we have cursing while Black. Right, talk right. about that. I thought that was just so fascinating.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. And so the chapter is called Contempt of Cop. And it really gets in, it's that play on, you know, sort of contempt of court, obviously, but it is a term that journalists came up with and others, but this notion of having an attitude, copping an attitude with the cops, right? Being disrespectful, being disobedient, refusing to comply. And so contempt of cop is like perfect for teenagers. It's what teenagers do. What do we know about adolescents? You just said it. Adolescents of all race, right? Act like adolescents. And they act like adolescents, by the way, all over the world, not just in the United States. So what does that look like? It looks like they're impulsive, emotional, reactive, fairness fanatics, among other things, right? Showing off for their friends. And so here you have, let me just say a word about the title of the book. So the book is Rage of Innocence, which has, you know, a number of different meanings. But one of the meanings is the rage in which the rage that Black children have after being told day after day, year after year, that they're bad or criminal. So what do fairness fanatics do? What do any of us who have any ounce of dignity do? You resist those labels. You push back on those labels. But if you're a teenager, if you're an adolescent, that pushing back, that resisting of the label, doesn't look like the conversation you and I are having, a logical, officer, sir, I don't appreciate, right, the way you're speaking to me. But instead, Black children feel targeted and they react, right? And that looks like profanity. It looks like yelling, some sort of adolescent outburst, and that escalates and spins out of control. So instead of adults being adults and remembering what it was like to be teenagers, it escalates into this and gets perceived as somehow Black children are more threatening. I often say also too that, sort of the cursing while Black, particularly at a police officer, is a form of protest. Right? It's a form of protest. It's a form of exercising one's First Amendment rights, but yet children don't have that, sort of capacity and that wherewithal to say it the way and to protest the way we might. So it comes off looking angry and dangerous and threatening. But, it's sort of a classic exchange, between a Black child and police officer today.
And perfectly understandable, in that sense, the rage that they feel, we get it.
Right, exactly.
And let's talk about adolescence too, because again, we're living in a time where we are all armchair adolescent psychologists, and we talk about the teenage brain as if we've all been studying it for decades. Right. And again, one of the things that struck me about your book was that you take that research, but again, you place it and you examine it in the context of the experience of Black youth and the ways in which it also is connected to the criminalization of Black youth. So share with us how I felt like you really talked about the ways in which it's the same but different.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, one thing is, again, this is another piece of the book that I learned so much from the research, and that was on the evolution of adolescence as really as a social construct in our society, right? And I didn't know this before doing this research, but that before the Industrial Revolution, really, we thought about development in two stages, childhood and adulthood. And we take it for granted now that there's this middle period, but it was because of the Industrial Revolution and the increase of, or the growth of skilled jobs that required, more education, more, a greater, more skilled labor force, for lack of better words. And so as a result, parents began to bring their children back in from the farm and send them to school for longer. So we then have the evolution of compulsory school attendance. We've got college coming, evolving. We've got professional schools evolving, and enrollment in all of those contexts is growing. But that those opportunities were really allowed for a privileged middle class, right? And Black children weren't given those opportunities. I say all of that to say that adolescence is a privilege. It really is a privilege that we have created, or white wealthy Americans created, quite frankly, you know, not too long ago in our history. And so now, while white children are allowed the sort of the privileges of adolescence, which includes, I would say, physical safety, which includes periods of adventure and experimentation, which includes extended periods of academic and social freedom, Black children are quickly shut down and put into their place through, you know, being arrested, being disciplined. You know, when they get to court, they're transferred and treated like adults. So this period of adolescence really doesn't exist for them. And so, I mean, I think that's one of the biggest things that we talk about, the difference. It's a privilege that white kids have that Black kids don't have. So experimentation, what does experimentation look like? It looks like experimenting with drugs, to be quite frank, right? We don't want any of our kids to do it, but, you know, the data shows that, like, by the age of, by the time children get to the 12th grade, over 50% of all children have tried marijuana. Right. This is of all races. There's data from the Center for Disease Control showing that children engage in the same type of risky, you know, delinquent behaviors that Black children end up in jail for, but white kids don't. Right. Experimentation with sex is a huge area. Black children are quickly, you know, demonized and criminalized for sexual experimentation. Don't get me talking about, you know, don't get us to talk about, you know, cross sex, I mean, cross race, you know, yep. Sexualization, all of that. So that's, I mean, that's really it. It's adventure, experimentation, you know, it's the evolution of political identity for white children that they get to do with freedom. And we have a double standard, right? Think about the opioid crisis, right? The opioid crisis, you know, was treated as a, you know, as a drug epidemic, as a, you know, as a medical mental health crisis when it was white children. But every other crack epidemic, all of that has been demonized and criminalized. So it's very different.
Yeah, I think it's, I really was, again, struck by your characterization of adolescence as a privilege, which of course is what it is. It is the social construct that we now have that allows teenagers to do all of that, try and fail, trial and error, try on different personalities, try on different clothing, try on different levels of anger in appropriate circumstances, try on different sexual personas
that are
important to normal, healthy development. To rob Black teenagers of that is really quite an extraordinary phenomenon in this country. And to not only deprive them of that opportunity to really go through what they would normally experience, but to go to that step of actually criminalizing some of that behavior and really shutting down and creating a negative spin on what white kids get to do.
Absolutely. And I got to say, Marsh, I mean, there's so many ways that we could, you know, sort of spin this out. I mean, part of it, you know, I wonder, you know, to what extent, and I talk about this in the book, it's intentional, right? So it's an intentional effort to preserve the boundaries of whiteness. And so that you shut Black children down before they grow up and assert their independence and, you know, take advantage of all of the opportunities that America has for them. So, right, you know, it's just, it's a very convenient time, you know, to criminalize Blackness during those adolescent development years. And so, you know, there's that. And then, you know, think about historically, you've got the Scottsboro boys, you know, were, you know, in their teens when they were accused of rape. You've got Emmett Till, 14 years old, you know, when he was lynched. You've got, you know, the youngest person ever, you know, who received the death penalty executed in modern America was 14-year-old Black boy. I mean, it just goes on. Tamir Rice was 12. It's just, you know, really critical times. And it makes a statement, right, about the limits of Black adolescence and what a Black child can become. And in order to justify those atrocities, right? Like the Scottsboro, boys and the Emmett Tills, you have to demonize them in the public narrative, right? So you have to paint them as a threat to white America, and in Emmett Till's case, a threat to white women. And then, so as long as that narrative lives on in society, it becomes embedded in our subconscious. And so that even people who subscribe to democratic values and racial equity still have those deeply laden fears about Black children, right? So we now have moved from an intentional limitation of Blackness to this subconscious fear of Black adolescents, both of which have the limiting force on Black children and deprive them of that privilege of adolescence.
And I think that Tamir Rice, the story of Tamir Rice completely matches what you just said, where you have a 12-year-old boy who is doing something that lots of white kids do, which is to play with a toy gun, basically. He's viewed as looking older, therefore looking scarier. And the speed with which he was shot, is something that is incomprehensible to this day. But again, I think you do such a great job in the book of also connecting the ways in which people's impressions that have been formed over time about Black children and Black teens. If you could talk a bit about that, how it provokes what really is criminal behavior by other individuals towards Black children.
Yeah. And so, right. So it's really, it ties in my mind, if I understand your flow, it's really sort of the ways in which we now function with our implicit biases. I was like, can we get to a conversation without talking about implicit bias? But it's really impossible, right? That intentional narrative becomes embedded in our psyche, and it really shapes the ways in which we engage with Black children, right? That then, spins out into something else. And so, like with the Tamir, Rice case, you talked about it, it's this notion of adultification. There are studies now by the wonderful Dr. Philippa Tebow Goff demonstrating that we look at a Black child, and I put all of us in there, we look at a Black child and we perceive them to be 4.5 years older than they actually are. Right?
Extraordinary.
It's extraordinary. That's not a little number, right? So Tamir Rice at 12 is perceived to be, 16 and a half. That's still too young to
close to 18.
Right? Exactly. Right. But, still too long, too early, to get the response that he got. But think about a 16-year-old, who's perceived to be 20 and a half or almost 21 years old, right? All of that matters. So what does that mean in terms of how do we respond, or how does society, and that's both civilians and police officers in the blue uniform, but you approach them, right, on the streets with fear, you perceive their actions as more aggressive and hostile than they really are, you see them in groups and they look like they're, mass terror. So the most normal behaviors become threatening. And I was actually thinking not too long ago, I had, walked through a park not too far from my house, and it was a very mixed, group of kids, but kids were all over the place, laughing hysterically. Some were tussling, some were playing, basketball, some were playing soccer, some were playing on their phone, sitting on the park bench, playing on their phone. I walked through the park thinking like, wow, this is so much fun. But if it had been like an urban, neighborhood with all Black children, everybody would be afraid of them. Somebody might've called 911, right? All of that happens. And so I think, Marsha, that affects it, not just what happens on the street, but then as we think about what happens when they get to court, right? We have no empathy. We know that teenagers make mistakes even, right? They engage, they're risk takers, they're sensation seekers. So when they do make mistakes, instead of like giving them a second chance or redirecting them or de-escalating their behavior, we're quick to refer them to court in the first place, or to treat them more harshly once they get to court, right? And so all of that, spins out. You're more likely to hold them in detention facilities instead of, in the community, more likely to transfer them to adult court. And once they get to adult court, more likely to sentence them to severe sentences like life without the possibility of parole. So,
yeah. I want to follow up on your comment about this notion that in a way we really don't give them the second chance that white kids get. Yep. And all of those biases, you know, they're unconscious, but they're conscious. They're implicit, but they're explicit. They follow Black children around.
Yeah.
And I think one of the other important messages of your book is to talk about, it's not just what we imagine about them, about Black children as they enter the juvenile legal or the criminal legal system. I think it's really important to talk about the trauma.
Yeah.
And I thought that you addressed that really, really effectively. If you could share a little bit about that.
Absolutely. So my interest in the trauma of Black children in the system really came from working with my own clients, right? And it was anecdotal at first. And it's kids, you know, just being so angry at police. We've talked about that a bit, but also just having so much anxiety. And I will never forget, and actually I write about this kid in the book, I call him Kevin. You know, not too long before the pandemic, I'm sitting in my office and I get a phone call, or one of my law students, I teach a clinic. So one of my law students is sitting in the clinic space with us and gets a phone call from our client we call Kevin. And Kevin calls to ask us if there is a warrant out for his arrest. And so we're baffled, like, why would there be a warrant? In fact, we had just been in court with him the day before. And so if there had been a warrant, the police would have picked him up. And we could hear his mother in the background yelling, "Boy, you're just being paranoid." So we asked some more questions, and it turns out that Kevin had been sitting in his window looking outside and saw a police car that was parked in front of his house for about 2 hours. And he was convinced that the police were out there waiting for him. And, you know, for somebody, you know, who thinks that, I can imagine many of the listeners are thinking, well, if you hadn't done anything wrong, then why in the world are you worried about the police, you know, waiting for you? But the reality is most of us don't live in neighborhoods where police are present 24 hours a day, coming and going, asking you where you're going, where you're coming from, asking you to lift up your shirt so I can see your waistband and see whether you've got any weapons. And so when I thought about all of this, I immediately connected the dots and thought, no, Kevin's not being paranoid. He's just traumatized. And so I really wanted to do research and figure out, is there a link between police presence and this over-policing and criminalization of Black children and trauma? And indeed, there is a growing body of research documenting the extraordinary ways in which Black and Brown children experience trauma as a result of living in heavily policed neighborhoods. And so the research shows that Black children and Latinx children who have been the frequent stop or targets of stops and frisk experience high rates of fear, anxiety, depression, hopelessness. They become hypervigilant, meaning that they're always on guard, not trusting police officers. That distrust of police officers transfers over to other adult authority figures like teachers. You know, so kids go to school and they're anxious and they see police in schools, and really just undermines their health and well-being. And the last thing I'll say about the trauma is the research shows that this trauma occurs not only from being the direct target of police contact, but also from hearing about it from friends, family, from people that you're close to. And of course, we know this from watching it on television and on the internet, right? And so the researchers have found this association between traumatic events online, including police brutality, and post-traumatic stress disorder. And so it's just some fascinating, fascinating research out there on this. And so it just helped me understand better what my clients were going through.
And I think also it's not only this sort of almost kind of indirect exposure to violence, but also, again, because so many Black teens live in communities where the over-policing exposes them to a very high level of violence,
yes.
That I as a white person in the neighborhoods that I grew up in was not exposed to. And so it is both through a TV screen, but it's also maybe outside their window. And I think, again, understanding what that does to the sort of hearts and minds and the healthy development of Black children in America is just critically important to appreciate.
It really is on a couple of different levels, because we always want to talk about, you know, so when we think we understand trauma, right, in Black and brown communities, we're thinking about high rates of violence perpetrated by the people themselves, without thinking about that really important layer of violence that is perpetrated, you know, by police, and not all police, of course, but by some police officers, and the what you talk about, the witnessing of it, right, in other places. So even if they're not the target. And so it's really important. The other thing that the research shows that, you know, people find, just people want to resist or discredit, is the ways in which over-policing actually increases violence in a community. And there is a good deal of research documenting that, right? That the stress that is associated with our contemporary policing practices are actually more harmful than helpful to entire communities on so many levels that we could tease out. And so I think people forget that. And the final thing I'll say is just, I really appreciate your comment about how, you know, you said, like, you know, as a white person, you don't, you know, realize the depths of it. And I think that's also true, you know, it's true across race, it's true across class. If you don't live in a neighborhood that is heavily policed, then you don't feel it. And then also, just to be Black in America, you feel it even when it's not there, right? So I don't live in a neighborhood where I walk outside and I see police officers, but you better believe I have the same fears of police.
So I know you note in your book, because we have lots of questions and I want to give the audience an opportunity to talk with you. You and I can go on forever and we'll have other opportunities to do that. But you did say you wanted to end on an optimistic note. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to imagine that maybe you wrote that sentence a little bit before the most recent environment in which we find ourselves, in which when we've been working in this space as long as you and I have, we need to be optimistic because we need to kind of get up every day and carry on the work. So I wanted to ask you, what makes you feel optimistic today? What makes you hopeful as you think about your work going forward?
Yeah, so actually I would say, you know, I remain hopeful. I think that same hope that I had at the writing of the book was really, I probably was editing up until June of 2020. So right around the critical, you know, sort of moments of racial tension. And I would say that a lot of my hope comes from adolescent resilience, or the resilience of Black children. And that although the killing of George Floyd was a very tragic moment, it was also a catalyst for a lot of people having the conversations like we're having right now, right? So I think that is a source of hope. And so that people are more willing to learn what they didn't know, right? So that's a huge piece of it. I also think that I'm hopeful that Black youth are resilient, but I will say resilience only works if they have the support of the rest of us adults, right? Of adults. And so a psychologist friend, you know, told me a phrase years ago that I have just loved, which is every child in this country needs one irrationally caring adult. And that children do better if they have a team of irrationally caring adults. And so I just hope that by conversations like this, that people learning what they didn't know about the traumatic effects of policing, for example, and criminalization on Black youth, that they will be inspired to do more to support Black children. So I remain hopeful.
As I said, I feel like we have to. All right. So let's turn to questions from our audience. Yeah. We have a question that I suspect you have gotten frequently. And that is someone who was looking at the data and acknowledging the very high disproportionate number of Black youth, probably both children and adults, who get arrested, and is inviting you to speak about whether or not that simply reflects what's going on, or if you can address the disproportionality that occurs.
Yeah. And so the critical question that I always kick back to people, and this is just because the data that we are given is arrest data, right? So the question is, what's the source of the data? It's arrest data. And so arrest data is driven by a number of variables, including resource allocation to Black and Brown communities. So if you send all the police officers to Black and Brown communities, obviously the arrest rates are going to be higher. So then the question becomes, well, how do I know? How, Professor Henning, can you say, you know, that adolescents are committing crimes at the same rate? Well, guess what? There's actually, most people do not know this, but there is national self-report data that has been collected for now, wow, I want to say almost 45 years. Quote me on that, but at least 25 years, I want to say 45 years, by the University of Michigan's Youth Risky Behavior Survey and by the CDC. And what it does is it collects from eighth grade, ninth grade, and 12th grade self-report delinquent types of behaviors that include everything from drug use, sexual promiscuity, and I include that because some people criminalize that for Black children. It includes like carrying a weapon to school, it includes things like, you know, getting into a fight, those kinds of things. And what it shows is that particularly adolescents of all races engage in the same types of behavior. White children, for example, use drugs at the same rate or higher all across the United States than Black children. But time and time again, you'll see data, and I'm reading from the question, the data would show that 62% or higher of crime is being committed by Black children or Black adults, when the reality is that's the arrest data. It's not the self-report data. And so that's my first first issue, or my first response, is that it's actually just not an accurate source of information.
And there's a kind of related question. And I know you and I have talked about this, and you did mention it. I think you talk about this in your book. Think about the school shootings, and obviously Columbine, though it wasn't at all the genesis for having more school resource officers in that environment. Most of the school shootings have really been largely by white children. And right. I think that's, I mean, talk about that for a minute, because I think there's sort of a reality check here.
Right. We live under, I don't know, for lack of better words, an illusion that our kids, and I'm speaking, from the lens of, a white privileged, person, that our kids don't commit crimes. Or if they do, they're just being teenagers. Boys will be boys, or, girls, are just, testing the limits. And the reality is, it's the same behavior. It's the characterization of the same behavior. But your point is about the mass shootings. Absolutely. I mean, the mass shootings have been by white kids in middle-class neighborhoods where they have had privileges. And I saw, I don't want to jump ahead to the questions, I didn't get to read it carefully, about the ways in which are we stereotyping, kids, and not all all white kids have the same privileges. I totally agree with that. but understanding, when I was talking earlier about social constructs, I'm talking about historical arcs, within our country, that the power holders have been predominantly white, who have created space, privilege, and opportunity. And with regard to mass shootings and grace and forgiveness, rehabilitation, second chances for white children, right? Because they've been the power source and the power base. Those privileges as a whole have not been afforded to Black children, right? In those same ways. And so I just, white children do some really awful things, and they make it into the headlines. And we as a country have figured out, in large measure, not always, but in large measure, how to handle them, right? How to respond to them. And when you think about some of the most, high profile cases, we are willing to recognize mental illness where it exists. So the Slender Man girls, right? That's an outlier case, but it's a really important case. You know, people were willing to acknowledge these girls had, you know, significant mental illnesses. You don't see that when we talk about serious crimes involving Black children. Instead, they are portrayed as antisocial, violent, beyond redemption, and transferable, you know, to adult court. Right. We think about the Ethan Couch case, the affluenza case, if people remember that, where the, you know, the kid, I believe he was from Texas. Please don't misquote me on that.
He was too privileged.
He was too privileged. Right. And he killed four people. Right. And like injured like nine. And, you know, he, you know, originally got his parents were allowed to pay for some rehabilitative service as opposed to sending him to a prison, a state prison, in, you know, an adult court, which is where so many Black children. So it really is a differential in how we respond even to the most serious offenses. Let me say one more thing about this, and I'll leave this point alone, is that we, again, as a country, know how to respond to the most serious offenses. There are evidence-based strategies for responding to serious offenders, multi-systemic therapy, family functional therapy. There are a number of different frameworks that have been demonstrated to be effective in working with even the most serious offenders, violence interrupters, credible messengers, things of that nature. But we don't want to take advantage of those when there are Black children involved.
Yep. No, and you document all of that in your book. We have a question that I think is a really interesting one, take us in a slightly different direction. And that is a listener who was interested to know whether or not you have gotten feedback or comments from law enforcement or other stakeholders in the criminal justice system.
Yeah, so it's a great question. So I actually work, so you know, I really, I go out of my way to be clear. My book is not an anti-police book by any stretch of the imagination. And in fact, I actually work with a couple of police departments, several police departments, I don't even say a couple, you know, several police departments around adolescent development, right? Either as a consultant or developing adolescent appropriate training modules for police officers, right? So here's my, so what is the reaction? I think the reaction, unfortunately, at the outset is far too polarized, right? So because policing has garnered such attention right now, and because it has become so politicized, you know, I was about to say as Black or white, but that's not what I meant, no pun intended, right? But as opposite ends, that we have a hard time having the conversation, and people, they don't really want to hear it at first. But if you honestly, if you read my book or if you sit down and have a conversation with me, you'll see that my responses are far more nuanced. Here's what I say. I do take the position that we have to radically reduce the footprint of police officers in the lives of all children, of all races, but especially Black and Brown youth, since they're so disproportionately targeted or in contact with the police. But that is not as radical as it seems. It just means that we need to be more thoughtful about what we use police for, what we rely on police for in our country, right? And relieve them of those tasks and responsibilities which they are not well equipped to do. And to be quite frank with you, most of them don't want to do anyway. You know, a police officer doesn't want to be called to the scene to deal with a mental health crisis or a teenager or a child, for that matter, who's throwing a temper tantrum, right? That's not what they're trained to do. It's not what they're equipped to do. It's not what they want to do. And so if we could reimagine, you know, policing to limit it to those areas in which they're best suited, then we would be better off. And so if you can have that conversation, if we can get to that space in the conversation, police officers are receptive.
Yeah, and I think that we know that lack of desire to engage in certain situations because we know the history of domestic violence.
Right.
Where police did not take it seriously, did not want to respond.
Right.
In a way, we forced them into that space. And we don't have time to talk about it tonight. I want to get to another question, but you and I know that some of that police enlarged role in domestic violence cases actually led to an increase in the number of young girls coming into the juvenile legal system. Just because of the sudden exposure that those families and parents and kids had to, again, law enforcement coming into their home.
It's so true. And I get to use a fancy word, which I do not use anywhere in the book. It really is a trade press book. But the word is iatrogenic, meaning that those things that we introduce, for public safety, for example, actually do us more harm than good, right? So we're actually, we have bought into the false binary that the only way, the opposite of the only way to achieve public safety is through traditional law enforcement methods. And in fact, the reality is, particularly in the school context, there's empirical research showing that policing in schools has actually been more detrimental, both to school safety and to children, and children in particular. And in that domestic violence context, right, that makes sense. It is the stress and the anxiety, the psychological trauma that is associated with that police intervention, which was meant to be good, right? So right. We introduced right. it to be helpful, ultimately is more harmful, it's more damaging. And so we see that with so much of policing of children. And I just wish, we could all just sort of understand that a bit more.
Yeah, and you do a great job in your book, I think, of also really educating us about the ways in which school policing has not enhanced safety in our school systems, but of course, in many respects, has made it worse. Right. I want to get to another question that I think is one you get a lot. And so I know that you can answer this one. And that is, we do have a listener who is interested in knowing what solutions there might be out there or remedies to address the kind of bias that we see in the system among stakeholders.
Yeah. So one of the things is, and I think this is the single hardest thing, is the narrative shift, right? Which is how do we get folks to see Black children as children, to see them as exactly the same as their own children and to see themselves in it. And I think people it's the hardest thing to get people to buy. When we talk about juvenile justice reform and policing reform, everyone immediately goes to that question, violent crime and Black children committing violent crime. And I have to say, number one, as a part of my narrative shift is getting folks to understand that the vast majority of children who are in juvenile courts, for example, are not there for the violent crimes that we fear: rape, murder, violent physical assaultive behavior. In fact, the stats show anywhere from 80 to 90% of children are in court systems for low-level nonviolent offenses, like property offenses and things of that nature. One of the most recent stats that I had, national stats, showed that only 9% of Black children, even of arrest statistics, of 9% of Black children were being arrested for those serious violent offenses. So first of all, shifting that narrative that Black children as a whole are dangerous and violent is really an important piece, is owning that data point. And then understanding that we are truly afraid of Black children for engaging in the same behaviors that other children. So I think part of the work, so how do we do the work? So what are the solutions? It is owning, doing the research, doing the reading, owning the narrative, checking your own biases, and recognizing what your triggers are, where you're afraid. I think it's getting proximate to Black children so that we can, dispel the myth that Black children are dangerous. And so that's a part of that irrationally caring adult, finding a space in which to tutor a Black child, to mentor a Black child, to volunteer after school program. I know that sounds very trite, but that's the hardest work to do, is to break down the myths and the biases that we have about Black children being dangerous. I think that's, and we're relying on those high profile media cases, and that's it, right? And not the, and not the reality. So I think there's that. I think there's a lot of work we have to do. Other solutions is really about a police free schools movement, right? It's about reducing, police presence. And people always say, well, we can't do that because the teachers are gonna be unsafe and the other kids. The reality is we need to adopt a public health approach to public safety as an alternative to traditional policing. A public health approach includes more mental health providers in schools, counselors, vocational experts, behavior intervention specialists, social emotional learning, smaller class sizes. And you all, there is empirical evidence on all of that, demonstrating how all of those things improve school safety. So I mean, there are a number, offer up a lot of suggestions in the book in chapter 12. Read it all right. To the end. No, just, but yeah. So
one last question, and we're going to go a little bit maybe from the micro to the macro, because I think some of what you just talked about was really what each of us as individuals can do and what kind of interactions we can seek out to address our own biases. But there's an interesting question, of course, about the kind of top line policy or reforms. We've been through 2 years, of course, post George Floyd, about a lot of very robust conversation about defund the police and the many interpretations of what that means. There's a conversation underway now about abolishing whole systems, about abolishing prisons and jails. So give us, sort of walk us out of your presentation tonight with a couple of top line ideas that you have that can really change the narrative that your book is about.
Yeah. So one is, okay, so, we can look at it legislatively, we can look at it individually, we can look at it in the courts. I think, I would love to say legislatively, I would start with some of the ways in which we reduce the presence of police in the lives of children, right? So one, reducing police presence in schools, and replacing it. I shouldn't even say reduce. I shouldn't even say eliminate. I should say replace it with these public health options, which means that lawmakers need to allocate funding. And I say this all the time when I get asked this question, we can't just do it at a surface level. It means that you have to meaningfully invest in the alternatives, meaningfully invest in a public health approach and implement it with integrity. I think that one of the, legislative fixes is we've been talking about use of force, or here's a better way to put it, a broader way to put it. When it is inevitable that police must come in contact with young people, then we need to mandate adolescent appropriate policing. So what does that look like?
I love that.
Right? So that means it looks like training in adolescent development. It means, and you'd be shocked at how few police departments have any training at all or have adequate training in adolescent development, training in adolescent de-escalation strategies, regulations that prohibit certain use of force against children, like pepper sprays, like tasers, like dog canine attacks. I mean, you'd be shocked. People think I'm just like, these are not one-offs across the country where canines are used to chase down children, who have run away. It's a part and parcel of the strategy. So use of force regulations, accountability measures, right? So holding police accountable to these standards that we set, those kinds of things, I think are some of the, top line. I think that we've got a, training with prosecutors. I've had some really, really fruitful conversation with prosecutors. Yeah. They, in my mind, prosecutors are the most powerful people in the system. People are shocked when I say that, but they are gatekeepers. They are gatekeepers in the system, so that children, Black children and Brown children who get referred to the court for normal adolescent behaviors, prosecutors can shut that door, right? And insist upon alternatives. So that's another strategy and suggestion. So they're throughout the system that we can think of. So.
Yeah, and here we are in Philadelphia, where we have a prosecutor who certainly I think is attempting to recognize the power that he holds, and to think differently about how he exercises that power. I think we are sadly out of time. This has been a great conversation, Chris. Thank you so much for writing this book. Thank you so much for telling this story, and best of luck to you.
Well, thank you, Marcia, for having me. You're the perfect person to be in conversation with, given all your work. So
it's been fun.
Yes. Indeed. I wish we had more time. I can't believe it. I feel like we just started. So thank you to Andy and to the Free Library. Really appreciate you all having us.
Thank you to our listeners.
Yes.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author-events.